This is the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Kathleen will be back on Thursday. V.I. Warshawski broke new ground in the genre of hard-boiled detective fiction when she came on the scene in 1982, and three decades later, she's still risking her life to take down the bad guys and stick up for people on the margins of society. Sarah Paretsky, author of 16 V.I. Warshawski novels, as well as a number of other works, joins me today on the Kathleen Dunn Show to talk about her writing and transforming the role and image of women in fiction. Her latest novel is titled Critical Mass. It's available in your local bookstore today. In addition to being a multi-award-winning New York Times best-selling author, Sarah Paretsky has a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Kansas, a Ph.D. in history from the University of Chicago, and an MBA from the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. Sarah Paretsky, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show, and thank you for joining me today.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, I know that our listeners are going to be very interested to talk with you and ask questions, so I'm going to let them know how to get in touch right away. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and we'll pass that along. We'll start taking those calls and emails and Facebook comments as soon as they come in. Critical Mass is your 16th V.I. Warshawski novel, and this one takes science as its theme. What inspired you to go in that direction?
Well, my husband is actually a physicist, and I was privileged through him to meet a lot of the really exciting people of the 20th century physics. And for a long time, he's at the Enrico Fermi Institute, and he was actually brought to Chicago by Mr. Fermi. So I wanted to write a book set in that milieu and try to capture some of the excitement that the men and women that I got to meet over the years had for what they were doing. And I have to tell you that Barbie was not lying when she said, physics is hard, because I struggled for about 5 or 6 years with research in the science part of the book and just never really got on top of it.
Well, I guess the interesting thing is that it's possible to make physics entertaining, and you certainly do that in this book. It's a critical part of the story, no pun intended. And I no spoiler alert here. I'm not going to give away anything more of the plot than I have to. But there are a number of characters who are based on real people in the history of physics, and in particular, there's a female character who's directly linked to a scientist, Marietta Blau. Could you talk about her for a little bit?
Yes, her story really haunted me, and it kind of propelled the book. Marietta Blau was a physicist in Vienna in the 1920s and 30s, and I learned a little bit about her, just by chance, a number of years ago. And the more I started reading about her and about Vienna during that period, the more it really gripped my imagination. Blau did such important work that Schrödinger, who was a Nobel laureate, kept nominating her for the prize, and the Swedes just never responded. And Einstein was another one of her sponsors and mentors. But Vienna was kind of a schizophrenic city in the 30s. It was sort of like half of it really wanted Nazi Germany to annex them, and half were really quite radical, thinking about art and music and science. And they had the first hot school lunch program for poor children anywhere in the world in the 1920s. So very odd city. And on top of that, they felt so strongly about involving women in science that almost 40% of their physicists were women, and that just hasn't existed anywhere else in the world before or since.
Well, I mean, that's a really significant point, because it truly was a unique situation. And what happened to all of these women scientists?
Well, as soon as the Nazis annexed Austria, and many of them were Jews and had to
kind of flee for their lives, or some sadly weren't able to flee and were killed. And then also the Nazi ideology was so strongly that women belonged at home. You know, the famous Kinderkirche, women's role was children, church, and kitchen, that they just didn't have a role for women. The women, even non-Jewish women, were pretty summarily dismissed. Later in the war, when they were losing and were down manpower, they started letting women do technical and management jobs again. But Vienna just has never recovered from this. I went there. I spent some time at the Radiation Research Institute where all this happened, and the guys who are there now said that it's just, they've just never, even now, 60 years after the war, 70 years, they've just never recovered that kind of creative spark that they had in the 30s.
Mm-hmm. The your parents were scientists, so you kind of grew up with that already as part of your background.
My dad was a cell biologist at the University of Kansas, and my mother didn't work outside the home, but they met in graduate school studying bacteriology together. And we actually had one night when I was about 7 years old, George Gamow came and spent the night with us, and he was a Russian refugee, great physicist, one of the Manhattan Project giants. And I have no idea, it never occurred to me when my parents were alive to ask them why George Gamow even knew my dad and why he came to stay with us. But he loved horseback riding and carried his saddle with him. And my brothers and I were all photographed sitting on his saddle very proudly.
Hmm. And he taught you a limerick about physics.
Yes, he taught me a limerick, which when I first started dating my husband, who, as I said, is a physicist at the University of Chicago, I recited it to him, and Courtney said, oh, everyone in physics knows that. But then when I told him who I'd learned it from, he treated me with a little bit more respect.
I would imagine. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number to join our program this afternoon. Sarah Paretsky is my guest, the author of the V.I. Warshawski novels. Her latest, Critical Mass, is just out today. And before I forget, because I have seemingly these days the memory of a goldfish, I want to mention that you have some appearances coming up in Milwaukee, two of them on Sunday, October 27th. You'll be at Boswell Books at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and at the Mystery One bookstore at 5, those coming up this coming Sunday, October 27th. And I'll be
and
sure to mention.
If you're in Wisconsin and you want a signed book and can't make it to the store, just call them or email them. They'll be glad to take your name. I'll personalize it to you and they'll mail it to you. So wherever you are, you can get a signed book if you want one.
Wow, that's great. And by the way, we have all this information on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. So there'll be a listing of the events connected with this book there that you can go and look at in case I forget to mention it again, which my producers assure me they're going to remind me before the end of the program. V.I. Warshawski, you've been writing these stories now for more than three decades. And
repeating that, you're making me feel my age, which is not as young as I would like it to be.
Noted. My age isn't as young as I would like it to be either, but my mother still treats me like a child, so I have that. V.I. Warshawski never seems to get any older, and I'm not the first person to make this observation, but she has evolved, I believe, over the course of these books. Tell me how she's grown and changed as you've been writing these.
When I started the series, I wanted her to age in real time. I was 34, she was 31, and I just felt that who she was had been shaped by the major events of 20th century history. Her mother was a refugee from Mussolini's Italy, and V.I. herself grew up during the civil rights era, the women's rights era. But I have fudged a little as I've gotten older and creakier, and I still want her to be able to jump tall buildings at a single bound. So she's moved basically from 30 to 50, while I've moved from 34 to 66. So she has aged, but not quite as fast as I have. And then also, as I get older and suffer a lot of personal losses, I just lose my appetite for killing people off in my books, at least the ones I care about. I'm happy to get rid of some of the others. So Lottie Herschel, who's V.I.'s closest friend and is a doctor, Lottie shouldn't be in the O.R. anymore, but she is. And V.I.'s downstairs neighbor, Mr. Contreras, who fought at Anzio and likes to talk about it, he'd be about 180 now, I think. But he's going to keep on trucking. So I'm just kind of doing what I said I would never do. I'm letting everybody hover around the ages that they are now, which is sort of 50 for VI and unexplained for the other characters.
Well, I don't think you're the other only writer of a long-running series to have done that. It certainly was true for Robert B. Parker and Spencer, among others.
Yes, I mean that was kind of why I really thought that she ought to age, because in the early books, Spencer's Korean War experiences really shaped him, and he talks about them a lot. And then after 30 or 40 years, it starts being ludicrous that he hasn't gotten any older.
Well, and when he's still making references to having fought Jersey Joe Walcott, that kind of dates him a bit, too.
So, but now that I'm getting creaky myself, I have full sympathy with Bob Parker for the decisions he made about that. We like to have our heroes be able to do the stuff we can't do.
Roger Ebert once wrote about the basic rules for creating a fictional private detective. He said these rules go back to Raymond Chandler. I'll quote him here. The PI must be dubious about true romance, hard drinking, occupy a grungy apartment, be loyal to unworthy clients, and annoy the police. Do you agree? And how does V.I. Warshawski meet or not meet those criteria?
You know, when I started out, I was so nervous about whether I could actually write a book and carry it off. I'd had this goal for a long time that I wanted to create a woman private eye who could kind of turn the tables on the stereotypic images of women in noir fiction. But I didn't have a lot of confidence, and so I really did, I didn't have those rules articulated, but Chandler, Parker, and an Indianapolis writer who's not as well known as he should be, Michael Lewin, their detectives were very much at the forefront of my mind, and so poor V.I., I killed her parents, and she started out as kind of a loner, but that's not my nature, and she quickly acquired a surrogate family in the form of Lottie Herschel. There's a bartender, Sal Bartel, who owns the Golden Globe. And just a cast of other characters who are really intimate friends of hers. The thing about romance, that's very tricky. I want V.I. to have a happy life, but if you're writing a series character and you keep bringing in love life, love problems, those kinds of things, what ends up happening is that the action of the book becomes very sluggish, and we keep getting annoyed by the side trips down the troubled romance part of the series. So V.I. keeps breaking up with guys, and also, of course, she is a street fighter and a pit dog and all those things, so it is kind of hard to be around someone who's as cranky as she is. I've given her the last couple of books. She's been involved with a bass player named Jake, and I keep sending him on the road on tour just so that their relationship isn't slowing the book down. And I hope for her sake that it keeps working. He's a good guy. She's an interesting woman. They ought to find happiness together.
Well, we'll just have to keep reading the books to find out how that all works out. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want to come back to the way that that V.I. Warshawski changed the genre of noir fiction, of hard-boiled detective fiction, and maybe opened the door for other women to write strong female characters who weren't vamps or victims. I'd like to talk about that a little bit more after we take a quick break. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's the number to call to join the program this afternoon. Email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also leave a comment or question on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Sarah Paretsky is my guest this afternoon. Her latest V.I. Warshawski novel is Critical Mass. It's in bookstores today. And Sarah Paretsky will be in Milwaukee this coming Sunday, two locations, Boswell Books at 3 o'clock and the Milwaukee Mystery One Bookstore at 5. That's this coming Sunday. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. In this hour, my guest is Sarah Paretsky, who is the author of the V.I. Warshawski series of detective novels. She's with me this hour. You can be too at 800-486-8655. The you referred earlier to how women had been portrayed in noir fiction and how you wanted to change that. How difficult was it to sell the character of V.I. Warshawski to publishers?
Thing about selling VI was that it was harder to sell a Chicago detective than it was to sell a woman detective. I actually had a letter from one editor saying that a book set in Chicago had regional interest only and that not enough people read in the upper Midwest to make it worthwhile to publish a book set here. So I kind of cherish that insult in a perverse way and like to rag New Yorkers about New York being flyover country between Chicago and Paris. But VI started in a very small, low-key way. It took my agent a year to find a publisher for her. And then her readership grew slowly over about the first five books and became a national bestseller with the sixth book. But it was so... It was a hard concept for a lot of people to grapple with. Some people just relished having a woman independent private investigator, and others found it just not acceptable. And some of my early mail was really kind of extraordinary. And one person wrote that a woman who talked back to men the way VI did should be beaten up, and you know, just sort of odd and horrible letters like that. And then I heard from a number of men readers, both here and in England, how much they responded to VI. So it was quite a mixed bag at the beginning.
And then you went on to create Sisters in Crime, an organization that supports women crime writers. Talk about that a little bit.
So when I was first starting out, it was easy for me to get my books reviewed in national publications, so I didn't realize that it was hard for a lot of women. I think it was easy for me, not because my writing was so much better than everybody else's, but because I was writing in the hard-boiled form, and that was perceived as a more masculine form. And similarly, Sue Grafton, who started just a little bit after I did, we sometimes think that we were Siamese twins in another life because we're always kind of linked together. But, you know, that's fine because we started at about the same time. She also got the same kind of press attention. And so it was a couple of years before I started meeting enough other women writers and hearing that they just couldn't get reviewed. And that's really important because now and then both, libraries are the biggest buyers of books unless you're just a huge runaway seller like John Grisham. So libraries
they have tight budgets. They make their buy decisions based on whether they see your name in at least two, and nowadays probably three, nationally recognized review outlets. So if your books aren't getting reviewed, you have a very short publishing career. So we got together. I convened the 30 women writers that I knew at a crime conference in Baltimore in the fall of 1986 and asked whether there was enough concern about these and some other issues that people wanted an organization to try to address them, and they did. And so that's how Sisters in Crime came to be. And the first thing that we did, John, was to run the numbers, and we got a list of all of the crime novels published in a given year and then looked at the reviews. And we found that a book by a man, adjusting for the percentages of books written by men and women, that a book by a man was seven times more likely to be reviewed than a book by a woman. And we said, well, maybe men write twice as well as we do, but we don't think they write seven times as well as we do. So we just started doing things to bring ourselves to the attention of the industry. We didn't want to be confrontational with publishers or with the New York Times or places that we needed. Instead, what we did was put together books in print that we started bringing directly to libraries and to booksellers, and we started putting together a speakers bureau so that our members could go to libraries and you know, just talk about their craft and get better known. And today, Sisters has about 5,000 members around the world, but more important, it created a place where women could get the support that they needed to start being successful crime writers.
Mm-hmm. Let me give the phone number again here before I forget that. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can join us toll-free this afternoon talking with Sarah Paretsky, who is the author of the V.I. Warshawski series of novels. Her latest, Critical Mass, is in bookstores today, I understand, although I've been working, so I haven't been able to get to my local bookstore. I did note you mentioned...
Put that phone down, John, and run out there.
You know, I think I would love to, but first of all, I already have a copy in front of me, thank you, but I think the management here would take exception, and I really need the gig. You mentioned... libraries. I did note that when I posted on Facebook that I was going to have you as a guest this afternoon and the book, several people commented in my stream that they were on waiting lists at the local library waiting for it to show up. And I'm not surprised. The one of your books was made into a film, Deadlock. Which I, by the way, that was the that was my entry book into V.I. Warshawski's world as an audiobook. Gene Smart voiced the audio version of that, and I happened to be going on a road trip, and I checked it out of the library. This is on cassette. This is how long ago that was.
Yeah.
And I was so taken with it, I went and got a copy of the book and read it, and then I started looking for others. Kathleen Turner starred in a movie titled V.R. Warshawski, which I will say was loosely based on Deadlock.
Very loosely, yes.
Yeah. What was it like seeing your story on the screen and looking at what the screenwriters did to the story that you originally presented?
Oh, my goodness, John. The families listen to this show, so I'm going to edit my remarks. No, Kathleen was great, and I call her that because she asked me to, not because I'm name-dropping. But she's such a smart woman. It was really interesting to watch her work. But the script was not a strong or credible script. I think Disney, having made the decision to make the movie, couldn't make up their minds whether they wanted to rehash Body Heat or whether they really wanted to do a Private Eye movie. And I'm sad to say this. I know the movie brought a lot of people a lot of pleasure. It brought my name to new readers when it was released internationally. But it just was a very weak script, and it's not surprising that it didn't do well commercially.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, when I think about it, there are a number of popular private detective series in fiction that attempts to bring them to the screen have failed, and it's always been a mystery to me why that is. One of the things is it seems like film writers somehow miss the point of mystery writing for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the one that I think of that I personally think is really successful aside from The Maltese Falcon, which you just can't beat that. But Ross McDonald, who had a really great kind of hard-boiled detective back in the early 50s and into the 60s, his character was brought to the screen by Paul Newman, and they changed the city. He was in Santa Barbara. They changed it to New Orleans. They changed the character's name, but they really caught the feel of the character, and that's what you hope for. I mean, that was what I wanted with V.I. I didn't care if Kathleen is this blonde who would never color her hair and V.I. is dark, and, you know, things like that didn't bother me if they'd gotten the atmosphere right, and that was what Paul Newman was so great at in the Harper movies.
Yeah, and you mentioned Ross McDonald because he did have a number of books made into films. Well, maybe it'll remain a mystery to me, as many things often do. let's take some calls. We've got Joan in Eau Claire who wants to talk to us. Joan, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Ms. Paretsky, what is the archetype of your protagonist, V.I., and what is your protagonist's fatal flaw?
I'm sorry, but can you explain what you mean by archetype?
The type of character, is she a very strong personality, type A? Is she the one that gets things done?
Is she the one that gets things done. I would say that her fatal flaw is the same in a way as some of her strengths. She's impulsive, she's loyal, she's dogged. She will really go to the limit for a person who she thinks needs her and that she can do something for. But probably her fatal flaw is a little bit lacking in impulse control. She in the new book in Critical Mass, she actually says that to herself. She goes into the book is a sort of a story. The backstory is set in science in Vienna, physics in Vienna, the quest for the secret of the atom and the atom bomb. And the front story is in Chicago with the physicist who was part of that group in the 30s. Her grandson is now missing, and V.I. is looking for him, and the trail takes her to some drug houses. And she's going into one on the west side of Chicago, and she's thinking, impulse control, when will I ever learn?
Yeah, what a drug house that the police have specifically told her not to go into.
Exactly.
Which is rather like waving a red flag in front of a bull, I would think.
Oh, sadly, it's true. V.I., I don't think she's ever outgrown the terrible twos. When somebody says no, she doesn't have a tantrum, but it doesn't stick with her.
Are you like that?
Somewhat. My husband says that I'm like a pit dog. I'll go into the ring against anyone as long as they're four times my size. And unlike V.I., I don't really have the wits or the physical strength to back up my kind of jumping off the edge.
Joan, thanks so much for the call. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Judith in Galena, Illinois joins us next. Judith, good afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Hi. I love V.I. She's probably one of my favorite characters. And being from Chicago, I'm from Melrose and Halstead. I'm kind of wondering if you have a very large Chicago readership. Yes, because I know all my friends who read your novels all can relate to the various places that VI goes and the situations and the bars and the East Side and the Bubbly Creek and everything else.
I grew up in a tiny town in Kansas, and here's what I think Eudora, Kansas, and Chicago have in common, that they're both incredibly supportive of their hometown people. This is a city that really turns out, I mean, for me, which I'm very grateful for, but for other writers and artists and actors, we're very fortunate to have the city around us giving us the support that it does.
You certainly embody, like, everything about Chicago, and we love it. And I think Jane Lynch would be an awesome VI for future movie endeavors.
Ah, that would be great. So I first came here. I was 19. I was doing community service work at on the south side of Chicago. You will know it, Judith. I was at 55th and Damon. And, you know, just taking kids all over the city on the L, that's what really turned me into a Chicagoan and made me cherish the neighborhoods and really want to dig into them. And I have to say that it's also, sadly, what made me a Cubs fan, because we were in spitting distance of Comiskey Park where the White Sox play, and the White Sox wouldn't return our phone calls, and the Cubs would give our kids free tickets every Thursday. So anyone who knows Chicago knows that our definition of an honest politician is one who stays bought, and the Cubs bought me all those years ago with those free tickets for our kids. And now I wish I could shake the habit, but I can't.
Well, once a Cubs fan, always a Cubs fan, I think. It's a special breed. My mother happens to be a Cubs fan, and she grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I never have gotten an answer to the question, why weren't you a Tigers fan, Mom? But I think she thought
it was... I was rooting for the Tigers. I, you know, I just feel when Chicago's out of it, I want some other Rust Belt city to win.
Yeah, I think that's probably true of most of us up in the Midwest, although I have a great deal of difficulty cheering for St. Louis. I don't know why.
Oh, me too. But they're not part of the Upper Midwest.
Well, okay, good.
They're down there. Nasty St. Louis Cardinals.
I hear you there. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue with more of our conversation with Sarah Paretsky, whose most recent V.I. Warshawski novel is Critical Mass. It's out in bookstores today. It has kind of a science theme, but V.I. manages to get herself into all sorts of trouble in the course of helping people who sometimes don't seem completely worthy of it. And that's something else that I would like to get into, Sarah Paretsky, when we come back, the kinds of people that V.I. chooses to work with, whether they like her or not. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sarah Paretsky is my guest this hour. You can join the conversation at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, and we're also on Facebook. Look for The Kathleen Dunn Show and leave your comment or question there. The like yourself, V.I. Warshawski is very interested in social justice, and you've made no secret of your interest in social issues over the years. Given the nature of the culture at this point in time, do you ever run the risk of V.I. being rejected by people who don't agree with her politics or yours?
Oh, I not only run the risk, I have suffered the risk, and it does make me wonder sometimes about what I'm writing or how I'm writing it. On the other hand, people criticize me for odd things that, you know, people who may be more closely aligned with me sometimes are more violent in their criticism of me than people who may not agree with me on everything. I've had some wonderful and really insightful letters from fans who are more conservative than I am, who I think are just incredibly gracious in being able to live with what they don't like about her in order to have what they do like about her. And what they like about her is her kind of intrepid spirit and her willingness to go the distance for the people that she's working for.
And people who are more closer to me, maybe politically or socially, will often write me furious letters. How dare you have VI eat meat? Don't you know what's happening to how that meat is prepared? And I'm like, guys, she's a fictional character. She can have a meal sometimes.
Yeah, I hear you. And VI often is trying to help people who don't treat her very well, who oppose her involvement in their lives in a number of ways, who make her investigations more difficult than if they cooperated with her. That seems to be a feature in a lot of her encounters with clients. Why is that? Why does she tend to be working and helping people who claim not to want her help, even though they need it desperately?
Oh dear! Now, when you put it that way, it makes her sound like a terrible masochist. In critical mass, that's a good case in point, because in Lottie Herschel, who is her oldest and closest friend, who's some years older than VI, Lottie grew up in Vienna and was sent to England with what was called the Kinder Transport, Children's Transport. England took in 30,000 Jewish children on the eve of World War II. They wouldn't take the parents. Nobody really foresaw what was going to happen in Europe, of course, and there was a lot of high jobless rate, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, and so on going on, but they saved 30,000 children, and I put Lottie on one of those trains. One of the children from Vienna who traveled with her, they were not best friends forever. They grew up not liking each other, but their lives keep intersecting over the years. They both end up in Chicago together, and this woman, when her grandson goes missing, turns to Lottie for help, and Lottie turns to VI for help. She's not an attractive client. She's very paranoid. She keeps changing her mind about what she wants VI to do. But VI sticks with her partly because of Lottie and partly because she can feel the real pain and loss behind the kind of angry and fearful outer layer of this woman's life.
800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I want to try out a theory about writing on you, because you're the first writer I've ever had the opportunity to ask this question to, so bear with me here.
Okay.
My experience has been that an author's later works are often longer than earlier works. Why is that? Is that true, or am I misperceiving it, or my theory is that a successful author gains more control over the editing process?
I can't answer for other writers. My books are longer because I think as I've gotten more confidence in my writing voice, I feel freer to say more about my character. I feel freer. My plots are, they often have very many strands and they take a lot of pages to work out. My first several books are quite a bit shorter than the current ones. And that's because I still was finding my way, and at least in a crime novel, an action novel, you can tell a pretty simple story and get from beginning to end. I also think that word processors allow us to be more verbose, and it's a tendency that all writers need to fight against, me included.
Well, Dickens got paid by the word, and I think sometimes you can really tell.
Right? Oh, my God, can you ever? I just reread Bleak House, which is one of my favorite all-time novels. But honestly, there were plenty of pages that if I'd been his editor, I would have whacked them out.
Now I've completely lost my train of thought. We have a question from Facebook, so I'll vamp with that. Lori writes, what comes first, the crime or the events leading up to it?
In my books, it's usually the crime that comes first, but in critical mass, I was so engrossed in my backstory, my physicist Martina Saginaw and her life in Vienna, that it was all about the events, and I had to really struggle, to tell you the truth, to come up with a crime that would work well and convincingly with those events that came out of the science or engineering realm and that I could understand well enough to make a reader understand. So the challenges that I had in writing this book were, for me, they were massive. They were a real stretch for me. I think that I feel in some ways more passionately about the characters in this book than in many others that I've written, and maybe that's because the events did come first rather than the crime itself.
Mm-hmm. So you had achieved a great deal of success with the V.I. Warshawski novels, but in 1998 you published a non-Warshawski novel, Ghost Country, and again in 2008, Bleeding Kansas. Why take the risk of writing outside of VI?
There were stories that I really wanted to tell. I think with Bleeding Kansas, it was set in the part of Kansas where I grew up, and it's always been kind of the in Kansas today. Well, let's not talk about Kansas today. It doesn't get a lot of national media attention, but, for instance, University of Kansas campus was, I think, for 13 months, the most violent university campus in the country during the Vietnam War, but nobody paid attention to it because Kansas isn't a media center. And similarly, the history of the Civil War and Bleeding Kansas leading up to the fight over slavery. And I wanted to say something about that and try to understand that and the lives of the people that I grew up with. Ghost Country, set in Chicago, but more kind of a magic realism novel, and pretty different from my VI series. And it was a big risk. Both books were huge risks. I was lucky that my publishers were willing to publish them. But I'm lucky that they've both found readers. It's hard sometimes to find readers who want VI and find Kansas instead.
Well, they don't want to, you know, there's a certain expectation that's created. And when something is different, then people can be disturbed a little bit.
Well, I mean, I can sympathize with that. There's an English crime writer, a good friend of mine, who I think is also a really wonderful writer, Liza Cody. And she wrote 6 books about a private eye named Anna Lee. I love those Anna Lee books. And Liza feels she said everything she has to say about Anna. She's not going there anymore. I think Liza's an amazing writer. I read whatever she writes. But I still miss Anna, and I want her to bring Anna back, you know. So I'm totally sympathetic to my own readers who were annoyed and wanted VI. I just mm-hmm. was grateful to them for being willing to follow me when I left the trail for a while.
Karen is on the phone with us from Milwaukee. Karen, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. And I'm usually not able to listen to the radio at this hour, and I happen to be running errands. I just wanted to thank you for the books you write, for the characters you create, and especially for shining light on kind of people and situations and circumstances that are really so often ignored in this society, and doing it in a more sympathetic or understanding kind of way. So I just wanted to express that, and thank you, and I look forward to lots more books.
Oh, thank you so much, Karen. That's so gracious of you. I really appreciate hearing that.
Yes, Karen, thanks. Thanks for the call. 800-486-8655. Still chance for you to get in before the top of the hour if you call us soon. The publishing has changed an awful lot since 1982. What's your take on where we're headed in the industry and what that's going to mean for writers?
I'm not a fan of conglomeratization. I think the only people who really benefit from it are shareholders. I don't think huge conglomerates benefit consumers or producers or anyone but shareholders. So it's 10,000 people have been fired in the publishing industry in the last decade, and editors now have to juggle many more writers than they ever did before, so they don't have the time to do the detailed work on manuscripts. A lot of their time is spent kind of in management meetings, just, you know, going through spreadsheets and Excel scenarios and so on. So there's I'm lucky that I have a very good editor, but in general, I think that it's just hard for editors to pay attention to books and to their writers and do the job that they really signed on to do. That's one problem. Conglomerates like big wins out of the gate, so they set the bar really high. It means that writers like me, who sold very modestly for the first five or six books, have a much tougher time getting a toehold and keeping going. But I think what will happen, my prediction, my crystal ball, I'm sitting here looking at my tea leaves as we speak, and my crystal ball tells me that cracks will start appearing in that, and that you'll start finding a lot more small publishers starting out wanting to take chances on the writers that the big houses just can't be bothered with. And my hope is, anyway, that you'll start seeing just a lot of good, quirky, new voices that will start getting attention as soon as small houses can figure out a good distribution system.
Well, what about the fact that that just about anybody can publish a work on Amazon and sell it for 99 cents a copy to whoever wants to try to read it on their e-reader? What does that mean for authors like yourself?
I think that anybody who wants to read should be applauded, and anyone who wants to write should be encouraged. And if they're coming together, that's great. We live in a time of almost no gatekeeping, almost no quality check, and it's true in the news as much as it is anywhere else. But you get something like 50 Shades of Grey. I confess I haven't read it. I understand it's not wonderfully written, but it spoke to millions of people, and more power to her for making that happen. So in some ways, the wide open range, it's a great boon. And in some ways, we're just kind of inundated with so much unjuried stuff that it's kind of hard to sort it out.
And will Critical Mass be coming out as an audiobook soon?
Yes, it should be out today as an audiobook. It should be out, I think, maybe I'm misspeaking, but Brilliance Audio usually publishes on the same day that the book comes out, so it should be there.
Okay. Well, I'll look for it. I'm on the road a lot, and audiobooks are my friends. So thank you so much for being part of the program today. It's been a real honor to talk with you and about your work.
John, thanks a lot. I appreciated the opportunity. And come see me at Boswell's and Mystery One on Sunday.
I wish I could. I'm on the other end of the state, unfortunately. Sarah Paretsky will be in Milwaukee on October 27th at Boswell Books at 3 and the Milwaukee Mystery One Bookstore at 5 o'clock. That's this coming Sunday. Sarah Paretsky is the author of 19 books, including the best-selling V.I. Warshawski novel, and her latest book is Critical Mass. Rhonda Fanning and K.P. Whaley produced this hour of programming. Tomorrow, here's what's happening at this hour. The New York Times discontinued its environmental blog, and two major universities ended their environmental science journalism programs. Is science journalism becoming an endangered species? I'll explore the question with our guest, award-winning environmental writer and NYU professor Dan Fagan. And a reminder, author and historian Jill Lepore coming up. next hour here on the Ideas Network. And by the way, if you missed a part of this hour and would like to go back and listen to it again, you can go to WPR.org and navigate to the Kathleen Dunn Show page and find an audio copy of this hour that you can download and listen to whenever you like. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.